Hi, everyone. I'm Sam Frank. I'm an editor of Triple Canopy. And this is Speculations, the Climate, a roundtable on solar geoengineering as part of Marfa Dialogues New York. Some of you might have come to our Speculations series at MoMA PS1 this summer, where we asked all kinds of people to think about the future and to try to like describe a future that they were optimistic about in some sense. And obviously, climate change came up here and there throughout. And people were really just, there wasn't much optimism there. The optimism that most people came up with was thinking through kind of zero growth economies, economies without much carbon input. Those are interesting, but thought experiments and you know, from a kind of left point of view, thinking about what a world without growth would look like. But, you know, this is not the world we live in right now. The mainstream climate debate is around sacrificing a percentage point or two of growth for some carbon reduction or so on. And people were not especially, they were very suspicious of technical fixes. For good reason, because technical fixes, you know, obviously are often used to just preserve the social arrangements we have now. But it seemed like there ought to be a way to kind of go beyond that opposition between technical and technical changes and social changes. And having a discussion around solar geoengineering seems like a way in. So solar geoengineering is and geoengineering more generally are technologies that would deal with some effects of climate change much sooner than we could perhaps with, you know, clean energy and so on. I mean, there is a level of inertia in the climate that, you know, even if you go to nuclear or some other zero emissions thing tomorrow, it will take the climate quite a while to readjust. So solar geoengineering, just as described by one version of it, described by David Keith, who just came out with this book, which is blurred by Bill Gates. So this is, you'll probably be hearing a lot from him coming up. I mean, he's given a TED talk on this, and he is a strong advocate. I mean, simplifying things, you'll see. But this is his scenario for something that would have global warming for the next number of decades. So he says injection of sulfates, so that's particles of sulfuric acid, into the upper atmosphere, might be accomplished by using Gulfstream business jets retrofitted with off-the-shelf low-bypass jet engines to allow them to fly at altitudes over 60,000 feet, along with the hardware required to generate and disperse the sulfuric acid. Only one or two aircraft would be needed to start the program, and after a decade, it would take about 10 aircraft to lift the required 250,000 tons each year at an annual cost of about $700 million. And this would, he then extends it out to 2070, half a century of operation, where you need 1 million tons per year with a fleet of 100 aircraft. And he says the necessary hardware could be ready by 2020, and even after half a century, the direct cost of the program would be less than 1% of what we now spend on clean energy development. So the argument basically for solar geoengineering is that it's a short-term fix that's quite cheap and quite powerful and gives us time to make all the other changes we need. Now, it's obviously more complicated than that, and that's what we're here to talk about. Like, we have three people who are conversant with the science but aren't scientists themselves. So we're not. It's not going to be like a debate about the science. And on the other hand, climate change more generally is such a huge topic that we're going to try to kind of keep it somewhere in the middle, like related to technology, related to the science, focused on a position that like how can social and technical change possibly be combined? Like thinking about that and what might that mean? Because I think it's a useful position to at least consider. And otherwise, these debates are taking place among the technocrats and others, and it's useful to figure out like how to engage. So with us we have three panelists. Christian Parenti, immediately to my right, is a professor of sustainable development at the School for International Training Graduate Institute. He is a contributing editor of The Nation and the author of four books, most recently Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, which is really an excellent book on the politics of climate change, the global politics and the geography of violence, and just the he talks about the armed lifeboat, you know, the possibility that rich countries and so on will protect themselves against the instability that the climate change is going to cause in a really violent way. To his right is Holly Jean Buck. She's a PhD student in environmental sociology and science and technology studies at Cornell. She's interested in how societies experience and retell the Anthropocene, an epoch in which human activity can be seen in geological strata. She researches how citizens and scientists understand climate engineering and how it is portrayed in the media. She has written really interesting pieces about how technical fixes can be used for other social possibilities and technical fixes in indigenous communities and elsewhere. So and she's worked, you know, around the world and spent time in communities, you know, not just in you know,
art galleries
in New York and the rich West. And then George Collins, at the far end, works with the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center, is a co-founder of the Geoengineering Scenarios Working Group. His focuses include climate common law climate litigation, international treaty processes, and the embedding of political models inside global climate models. He's also working on sound art around climate change, and he's contributed to Triple Canopy with some flash programming in the past. And he's going to begin. The work he's been doing is around just all the many uncertainties, especially.
So thanks everyone for coming. As Sam suggested, I've worked on a number of different aspects of climate, and I think it actually may be a mistake only to work on geoengineering, though I have been working on that in some capacity since 2009, 2010, starting mainly with the Asilomar Conference, which was an attempt that may come up later to assert a body of standards that would govern research in the area, and I think personally that it largely failed to do that, and this is still a really open question. Should there be research in the subject? How should it present itself? What kind of research is legitimate now? What kind of research might never be legitimate? I think these are all open questions. I should say, though I do work with the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center on climate generally and geoengineering, I'm not speaking in any official capacity. The RCRCCC doesn't have a position on geoengineering in a sense, neither do I, and I see my role now to express some of my deep doubts and fears and concerns in hopes of queuing up some questions. The danger with speaking first is that you can construct a map for the argument, and I'm going to try to be incoherent enough in my presentation that you all will have new thoughts and hopefully confront us with things that haven't come up before, as the conversation can get repetitive. So just to talk about the science for a little bit, many of you may be familiar with this. In fact, how many people have read more than two articles about solar geoengineering? Okay, definitely talk about the science a little bit. People have probably a basic grasp, at least, of how climate change works. In terms of greenhouse gases, humans are changing the atmosphere in all sorts of ways. Lots of things change the atmosphere. Trees change the local atmosphere by emitting organic molecules that make it better for them. But humans do it in a particularly large-scale, clumsy, and non-deliberate way, emitting, you know, at least 15 categories of substances that have a variety of fairly complex effects. Typically boils down to a conversation about carbon dioxide equivalent, but it'll be important for the geoengineering discussion to bear in mind that there are actually a lot of gases and particles, and they do a lot of different things. The core problem with climate change, though, from a greenhouse gas perspective, is that high-frequency radiation is coming into the Earth from the sun, and Typically, it's absorbed and re-emitted as low-frequency radiation, and some amount of that is bounced back by the atmosphere, and that warms the terrestrial biome, without which there wouldn't be life on the planet, but a certain amount of it escapes, and the planet had reached a pretty comfortable equilibrium with that. We're now trapping the low-frequency infrared daily increasing amounts, and more of it is being reflected. So it's a little like clogging up the exhaust pipe of a car, is a metaphor that people sometimes use. Stratospheric solar geoengineering, which is probably the front-runner proposal, it's the one that David spends most of his book talking about, is a proposal that actually it doesn't deal with greenhouse gases. It attempts simply to reduce the amount of incoming high-frequency radiation, essentially reduce the amount of light. If you could do it by turning a dial and dimming the sun 3%, you might do it that way. We don't have that dial, and so the technical proposal is typically to inject some sort of particulate matter at a very high altitude, hope that it stays up there, and hope that that will reflect a little bit of light so that less comes in, less is absorbed, less is trapped by the greenhouse gases that we keep putting into the atmosphere. There are other solar proposals ranging from pretty straightforward proposals like painting roofs white and making it have white highways and not black highways. That it's a fairly uncontroversial proposal. The question is, will it work or not? And there are kind of medium proposals like brightening clouds over the ocean. It's more of an ongoing process. You're not actually really emitting pollutants, but it can have unpredictable climate effects the way that any of these technologies can. And within the geoengineering space, and I think we can focus more or less on this depending on interest, there are also techniques that attempt to remove carbon dioxide that's been emitted from the atmosphere, not stop it from being emitted, not sequester it right after it's been emitted, but actually suck it back down. Those have been called carbon dioxide removal proposals. The term you will now see is greenhouse gas reduction removal proposals, because it turns out there are lots of greenhouse gases, and the terminology finally caught up. So the key technical point, I think, around SRM is that mitigation, we're paying now in terms of temperature increase for greenhouse gas emissions that happened 30, 40, 50 years ago. We're still paying in some degree to greenhouse gas emissions that happened at the beginning of the era of greenhouse gas emissions. It's a very slow onset. It takes the Earth system a lot of time to warm up. And these molecules can exist in the atmosphere for very long periods of time. The corollary of that is that if you reduce greenhouse gases, you may not see effects for an equally large amount of time. Now, that doesn't make mitigation less important. That makes mitigation more important. But the problem is, politically speaking, you don't necessarily see instantaneous results if what you're doing is just reducing the amount of emissions of greenhouse gases. And physically, scientifically speaking, if you're faced with an emergency situation, it means that you're already on a path of increased warming, even if cold fusion is miraculously invented and we fully decarbonize the economy now. It's a better situation, but we still have a problem. And one of the typical proposals for why SRM is something worth thinking about at all, given, and I think from the nature of the concept, I hope people take it for granted that modeling of these things and their consequences is incredibly hard to do. There are huge scientific uncertainties, and I don't think anyone serious working in the field would dispute that. The question is what to do with this, because there may not be other approaches that can reduce temperature quickly in the very short term, like 6 months to a year. Cleaning up the energy system doesn't do that. And so you can imagine a situation, and people do this, in which methane is being released in large quantities out of Arctic ice that's rapidly melting. You're faced with the prospect of an ice-free Arctic. What else do you do? If that's the future you end up in, which it could be, nobody knows how likely that is, but it's a non-zero probability. Do you want to have thought about these technologies or not? Now, it turns out there is one other thing you can do, which is reduce the amount of warming aerosol pollution. It's not greenhouse gases, it's warming aerosols. Humans emit that too, and if you clean that up, you can get a reduction that happens awfully quickly. And there are some tangential issues related to that may come up later. But other than so-called short-lived climate forcer mitigation and solar radiation management, we don't really have a spate of technologies to address short-term temperature effects. And how worrying that is depends on how concerned you are about the prospect, not just of climate change degrading everything and making things worse and, you know, increasing the amount of suffering in the world, but suddenly changing things dramatically for the worse. And that's an open question. Now, we know from the ticking bomb problem in torture that if you control the suppositions of if I can give you any hypothetical, you could justify almost anything on that basis. And I don't want to torture this point, but the reason that I can't leave this idea behind entirely has to do with this question around emergency management. That's just a personal statement, that I don't know what the other response is. I don't know if the Kivalina community, which if anyone hasn't seen the exhibit back here, you should definitely take a look at it, facing the complete dislocation of their village because of ice loss in the Arctic. And I don't know. I don't know what it means for a community like that or the small island states to say, we don't know what the other options are that will actually help us right now. This is an uncertain technological gamble. We might want to consider making it. I think from a left perspective, it's a little, you might be able to analogize to nationalism, that you can see all nationalism as problematic, but all nationalisms aren't necessarily equal. Hawaiian nationalism isn't necessarily the same thing as U.S. nationalism. So I think that's a hard problem, but then we get into another real problem, which is if you have accepted that this technology might serve some role in climate emergency management, and you've convinced yourself that somebody could be competent to decide which emergencies count and how you would manage them, which is another problem, you then have to think, if you're developing this apparatus, what stops it in the existing world, the political world that we deal with, from being used by a variety of people to serve a variety of purposes? It might start with, well, it's not an emergency, but things are really bad, and what we need to do, and this is, I think, what Sam suggested, is sometimes called peak shaving. Do a little bit of SRM while we clean up the energy system and, you know, fix agriculture and do all of the stuff that we should have done 50 years ago when we started becoming aware of this problem seriously. It buys us some time and arguably reduces suffering. Then do you actually take that a little more? Do you say, well, these other things might work, but they're really difficult and they're really expensive, and maybe this turns out to be a cheap option, and maybe the risks involved in deploying these untested technologies are less than the existing risks of uncontrolled climate change, if that's the opposition. And then do you say, well, this is great, let's do this, let's just do this. And then you go farther and say, let's do this not to serve some sort of imagined global plan that we've all agreed upon somehow, but to serve local economic interests or military interests. Jim Fleming has an amazing book called Fixing the Sky, which traces the long history of weather modification attempts, particularly from a military perspective. It's not exactly a slippery slope. These are qualitatively different positions, but how people feel about the question of research into this or even discussion of the subject now has to do a lot, I think, with how far down that line they think things might go. And the key questions for me are, what would a governance system look like that could make legitimate decisions about emergency management? And is it even ethical to research or discuss the subject if you're worried that the mention of this possibility of something that could work will further distract people from the things that they really need to do now, which are mitigate greenhouse gas emissions, clean up short-lived climate forcers, and adapt to the amount of climate change that we know we're going to face in a sensible manner that reduces the amount of human and non-human suffering? I think that's a hard problem, but I can't shake the concept entirely, even though I'm nervous about it, and that's where I am.
So, thank you all so much for coming here today. What I'm going to talk about a little bit is this question that I've been grappling with of how is the concept of geoengineering useful? How can we use it imaginatively? Because when confronted with climate change, I feel like the first go-to question, the question number one, is how can we keep this thing stable? So we want to stabilize emissions. We want to stabilize temperatures. There's a lot of talk about you know, what fuels we can use to keep our car system going and so forth. It's this, like, holding stable type of mentality. And we're asking that. We're not asking the question, what kind of world do we want to live in? So I'm interested if the idea of geoengineering can help us get to ask this question number two more often. And I've been noticing that when it comes to the environment, citizens are usually put in a defensive posture. So we think about environmental defense. We have the sense that our land, our water, our quality of soil, or whatever is constantly being eroded from these outside forces that are coming in. And that makes a lot of our actions reactions against that. And then when we do have an action that's in with through nature, it becomes something like geoengineering, where it's construed as a manipulation or intervention or management, with a lot of really negative connotations about what it means to manipulate or intervene, even though manipulation comes from the hand, you know, a very human thing of working with your hands. And I'm concerned that we don't really have a vocabulary that's adequate for talking about another type of relationship with nature, which would be something like actively, creatively tending the wild, or we don't have much vocabulary for imagining humans in nature in a different way. That's not to say that there aren't some ideas. People talk a lot about permaculture, agroecology, biophilic cities, living in a rambunctious garden, or whatever other types of metaphors and techniques that are out there, but my sense is that a lot of these haven't gone mainstream, and none of them are compelling to people like David Keith, who wrote that book, because they're all too small. They're not planetary. And solar geoengineering, in the scheme that he focuses on, the stratospheric aerosols, is all about bigness. Whereas I think that there's a lot of potential for human intervention in nature on a small scale way that's building a relationship, and that all of those actions can be scaled up to evoke a quite profound level of change. And I wanted to talk about Keith's book a little bit. It's called A Case for Climate Engineering, and that's exactly what it is, very straightforward title. And what he does in that book is collapse geoengineering and only talk about one technique, this technique about the stratospheric aerosols, which is, I feel like, something that's been happening over the last 5 years or so. It used to be when you'd read an article about geoengineering, it would be like all these wacky ideas. There would be this multiplicity of techniques. And slowly it became that we're talking about this very crude technology, which is basically creating a layer of pollution. It's just so inelegant from a design standpoint, an aesthetic standpoint. But that became now what we're discussing. And there's a lot I don't agree with about the book, but there's a few arguments worth mentioning. Firstly, he says that it's possible that since this might really help vulnerable people, not looking into it is unethical or unhumanitarian, which I think is an argument we have to take seriously. But there's just so many unknowns. And secondly, he points out that most of those arguing that we should ignore geoengineering because it will divert us from true solutions, such as emissions cuts or deep-rooted social change, are themselves wealthy and educated. Which I think is also true, although those are the people who tend to actually know about what this thing is. So that brings up the point that we don't actually know what people in other countries, cultures, socioeconomic situations, etc., think about this idea, which is a huge social science research challenge. Speaking as a social scientist for a moment, it's a big methodological problem if you want to go find out what other people might think of this idea, because if they don't know about it, you have the task of informing them about it, and then you're going to bias their response because you're the one who's delivering the information, and it's going to have some kind of slant that you bring to it. So I'm wondering that maybe stratospheric aerosols look so bad that it forces us to ask what might be good, or a best case scenario. And I think scale is a huge part of this. Some techniques like stratospheric aerosol injection are the extreme of planetary and non-participatory, But then there's other ideas that have been floated that are a more communal scale. So there's this idea about marine cloud brightening that with special ships would go around and spray sea salt or other things that would make white clouds, and that would change the albedo. And you could have that on a more regional scale working around. The ocean iron fertilization project that took place off the coast of Haida Gwaii last year is another example, which I could talk about, that was basically a type of village science. It was done, funded by a village with kind of specific effects for that village. And then you have also a more individual scale, which would be more like climate smart agriculture, biochar, other techniques you would use on a very small scale. And I think that some kind of integrated systems would be an interesting way to go. And I think that we're still thinking of geoengineering from a Cold War mentality, so Manhattan Project, big projects, military interests, et cetera, which I think this is an example of. And we're not thinking about the recent trends in the information age, which look a lot more distributed and coordinated. And I'm interested if there's convergences that we can look at. A lot of times when we think about the future, we project one element that we're thinking about into a future that looks something like things are today. But if you start looking at the different technologies that are developing, and this happens a bit in geoengineering when people are talking about nanotechnology or synthetic biology and combining those. And I think that information technology is really powerful, and we haven't looked too much about how that can combine with geoengineering to make up a different framework of human involvement in nature that looks not like what Keith's proposing, but something a lot more exciting. And I'm going to stop there. I feel like I've been talking for a while, but we can come back to any of this.
All right. Thanks for coming out on a Saturday afternoon at a finely seasonally appropriately crisp Saturday afternoon rather than unseasonably warm, as they seem to be all the time. Why would one even consider geoengineering, right? Well, as has been touched on, because the possibilities of just continuing with business as usual are truly terrifying. And that's what we're doing. We're just carrying on with loading greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. And it's become clear really only in the 1990s with the extraction of the ice cores from Greenland that a formerly sort of fringe position about how climate change happens has now been understood to be like, okay, this is actually the way it happens. And that is that the climate system changes much more quickly than was previously thought, that the causes can build up and the effects lag and then kick in all at once. And it was the extraction of the Greenland ice cores where there was evidence of this sort of sudden shifts in global climate regimes over the course of a decade or a couple of decades rather than centuries. So we're now aware of the fact that these tipping points in the Earth system are real and very, very dangerous. So this means that our experience of the weather is in no way adequate for understanding the nature of anthropogenic climate change. It really does require a kind of adherence to science and an abstraction out of the context of your sort of empirical reality. So some of these tipping points, as have been mentioned, could be like the melting of the Arctic permafrost releases all this trapped methane. That alone would really increase the rate of warming, because methane is a greenhouse gas 20 times more powerful than CO2. So that's why one would even consider such radical, possibly outlandish things as creating false, fake volcanoes, pumping sulfates into the atmosphere. And politically, already we can see the sort of the bad future of climate change, which is that when people in the global south are pushed to the edge by a combination of bad economic policies, this is what I wrote about in Tropic of Chaos, the way in which 30 years of neoliberal economic restructuring has reduced the state in the global south to a shell of its former self, So it has very little capacity to help people. At the same time, the Cold War has littered much of the global south with weaponry and men who know how to use guns. And now, third element is the extreme weather associated with anthropogenic climate change is kicking in. And for people who live with very little margin of error economically because they're subsistence farmers or pastoralists or artisanal fisher folk, a couple of bad years can push them into destitution. And so then they have to adapt with whatever means available. You can't turn to the state. If the state has been reduced to an organ of debt servicing, and there are no agricultural extension programs, there's nothing for you. Well, what do you fall back on? If there's lots of guns around, you can make up your losses in the short term by turning to banditry, by, you know, turning on your religious or ethnic neighbors. And you see that happening already. And the response is, unfortunately, increased sort of counter-terror, counter-insurgency from core economy militaries. All of which touches on a point in all this that, you know, when we're talking about geoengineering and the possibilities of this, we have to keep in mind that we're talking about this taking place on a planet in which the global economic system is capitalism, right? And there are core and peripheral economies. And the peripheral economies are not connected to each other, and they are more connected to the core, and there's a flow of, and it's a fundamental power imbalance between the global north and global south. And these decisions, if they are going to be made, and to the extent that they are being discussed and made, are being discussed in the core. And I think it's, you know, it's worthwhile to try and democratize that north-south split. But fundamentally, these are solutions that are going to be imposed upon the rest of the planet by core economies. There are very few processes that happen at a global scale that are actually democratic, that you know, kind of do the things that you were suggesting of trying to figure out where the mass of people on this planet are at and get their voices involved. That's fundamentally not how international politics works. So this is the problem. These are the reasons why one would think about this. On the left, the position, I mean, interesting, it's the other two speakers here get some kind of like agnostic and sort of like conflicted about it. I feel the same way. It's like, I mean, I'm fundamentally like against the idea of big, huge techno fixes. They just don't work that well. Look at fill in the blank. Look at atomic power. Look at even, you know, big hydro, as benign as that is in a way, I mean, how it has devastated fisheries by killing rivers, which then kill the marine fisheries dependent on the nutrients coming down these rivers that are now blocked by dams. So there's a lot of precedent of big technological fixes having very bad unintended consequences. So the left response typically is to just reject this stuff out of hand as insane, and to do so from this basis of sort of defending nature. So nature is this thing and where it's caretakers. But what geoengineering requires, that I'm part of the conversation, is to really, as the other speakers have said, is to really rethink these categories of human society and nature. And it is, you know, I think it's, there's, if you look at the origins of capitalism environmentally, you see how sort of flimsy and useless those categories are. So the whole story begins with the Columbian Exchange, the knitting together of the old world and the new world. The transfer of plants and animals and diseases from the old world to the new world creates a completely different world ecology, leads to 90% of the population in the Americas dying off, that allows European colonization, political and military advantages, the flow of new world foods to the old world, like the potato alone. I mean, there's a great book on the potato, but there's much more that could be written about this, the role of the potato alone in the birth of capitalism, producing a population explosion that is the basis for there to be a urban working class that can work in factories and becomes the human inputs of industrialization. So from the very beginning, 500 years ago, of the emergence of this global system, we see that this idea that there's this pure good thing, nature, falls apart. I mean, there really hasn't been something like first nature for 500 years. We could say there's nature where people have not affected it. In the Americas, we now understand that Native Americans in North America basically through anthropogenic burning had the East Coast was sort of treated like a giant game park. Instead of domesticating animals, Native Americans domesticated the landscape with massive burning every year to create edge habitat, which is sort of, interestingly enough, the suburbs have sort of recreated this. And that's what, you know, deer like the line between fields and woods. So there's all sorts of intervention at every level in very, you know, in traditional societies and modern society. So this idea that nature is this thing that has to be preserved, I think, is highly problematic. We have been producing nature for minimum, you know, 500 years at a global scale. So, I mean, we've been producing it ever since we first started lighting things on fire and first started scraping the earth and allowing erosion to kick in and stuff like that. But certainly at a global scale for 500 years. And so I think we have to think much more in terms of how we are not the stewards of nature, but we are part and parcel of a system that, whatever the language is, social nature is a term that Jason Moore has been using, who is a sociologist, sort of economic historian, environmental historian, who's now up at Binghamton, that nature is always socially produced. And one of the key categories that produces, intentionally or unintentionally, nature by mediating human and non-human nature relations through the labor process, one of the key institutions that manages this is the state. It is the state that is the ultimate landlord and that has historically delivered nature to production, or conversely, preserves parts of non-human nature, reserves it for, you know, game parks or natural parks or whatever. So the state is fundamental in this kind of, in the metabolism of social nature. And if we are going to have a non-disastrous response, sort of technological response to climate change in terms of some sort of geoengineering, whether it's carbon engineering or, you know, pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, or whether it's this use of sulfates, the state is the fundamental category that has to be rethought and introduced into the center of the discussion. And I think that's particularly important for Americans because we have a sort of, you know, knee-jerk anti-statist position. You find it on the right and you find it on the left, right? On the right, it's the Tea Party, et cetera, et cetera. On the left, it's the kind of the many brands of horizontalism, from anarchism to a kind of, like, you know, transition town, small town romanticism. But the state continually drops out of the discussion, yet it is ever present in the economic reality. But one of the main ideological and intellectual victories of neoliberalism, the right-wing turn that begins, you know, 30, 40 years ago, 35 years ago with Reagan and Thatcher, it's almost just been to disappear the state completely. So we don't even talk about it. So I think that at the heart of the questions around engineering the climate has to be not just the technologies and the money, but really the state. What is it? What is its responsibility? And fundamentally crucial in all this is the fact that the state is both, you know, the handmaiden of capital, helps reproduce it, cleans up its mess, but also is always regulating it, is always controlling it, is always limiting it. It's another thing we forget, because there's been so much rollback of environmental regulations. Well, if you talk to the managers of an oil refinery, you know, if you talk to the environmentalists who live next to live in the communities next to the oil refinery, you hear a story about how these guys violate the rules. These guys are not under, you know, any kind of control. They're polluting the environment, all of which is true. We talk to the managers of an oil refinery, which I've done, and they have a very different story, which is also real, which is important to remember. Which is like, no, we spend billions of dollars trying to clean this stuff up, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you realize, okay, well, never mind whether it's sufficient. I don't think it is sufficient. But you realize, oh, capital and its managers, they're very oppressed. They're intimately oppressed by the state all the time. If they got their way, there would be no environmental regulations. They would pay no taxes. And, you know, the whole system would collapse and be unable to reproduce itself. So the state is ever present, and we have the sort of the kernel of what must be done, which is not just pampering capital, but also regulating it, controlling it, saying, you know, no, here you may not go, here you may not cut down the forest, here you may not dump your pollution, and there isn't going to be any kind of a reasonable response to climate change in terms of adaptation, mitigation, sustainable forms of economic development, or any kind of geoengineering, carbon engineering, without the state being fundamentally rethought and reintroduced into our discussions politically.
So maybe just we can try to just have one more kind of round and then go to questions. But, what Christian said about how this will probably be the global north imposing itself on the global south, I mean, one thing that's interesting in Keith's book is that the claim that because this stuff is potentially so cheap yet so globally impactful that, like, maybe it will rearrange certain power relationships and that poorer countries or individuals outside the state could act on their own and you know, in their own interests. So I'm just kind of interested in kind of going into these different ideas around governance and also who is agency here a little bit more. I mean, Holly, you know, especially once you get past geoengineering, which has solar radiation management, you get into these things that are more local potentially and have this proliferation of different strategies that can be deployed by people for their own local needs. But I mean, George, you've done like scenario modeling where you've tried all these different thought experiments and seen the variety. I mean, obviously, no one knows who will have the power here, but like what's the useful range of thinking about these things, and then maybe we can continue down the line.
So, in the short term, and of course, scenario techniques for those who haven't heard of them or used them, don't try to assign probabilities to things. They try to explore interesting corners of the probability space and try to feel out what seem like just, you know, things that you don't end up really thinking could happen versus things that might. And in terms of the small actor question, right, whether it's a coalition of a few willing countries or the frequently called Greenfinger type individual, I think the problem that I've heard come up when people try to think that through isn't about starting the process, it's about persisting in the process, if what you're talking about is stratospheric release. Because planes have to keep flying. Now, you can come up with a techno-scientific imaginary around nanoparticles that you just release and they loft up to the atmosphere and stay there, in which case it's unclear how you would even attribute geoengineering. But then you get into questions, and actually in our first scenario report, this was something that came up. Do you get people doing local attempts to engineer local climate that counteract each other or somehow compete with each other, or do you get three people moving things in the same direction and end up three times farther than any individual planner had wanted? And those are probably more relevant questions with more futuristic technologies than with the kind of proposal that David's suggesting, just on a kind of pragmatic basis about which countries have large air forces. I mean, if a core economy decided to do it and really decided to stake out a sovereignty position on it, that would be one thing. But the sense that Palau, who might have more of an interest in attempting this, would actually be able to run that kind of operation from a financial perspective is not impossible, especially with private support. From a pragmatic perspective in the face of core economic opposition, my sense is not so much.
Holly, would you maybe talk about Russ George and some of and that paper you wrote?
Yeah, well, I think Russ George is the least interesting part of this event that happened last year. So there's this idea that if you put iron into the ocean, you create a plankton bloom. That's pretty much well known. And then, in theory, some of that plankton bloom would sink to the deep ocean, in which case you would have sequestered some amount of carbon. You've removed it from the cycle. And so there have been, in the past 10 or maybe 15 years, some ideas that you could create these plankton blooms with iron or other nutrients and hence get carbon credits for sequestering this carbon, which at present is totally not possible because the way of calculating and monitoring all of that cycling doesn't exist. But that hasn't stopped some startups from kind of going there. And so what happened last year was that this group called the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation, largely driven by the economic development officer in this village and some of his colleagues, tried doing this. And
what country was this in? Canada?
Well, Canada, but that's part of the tension there. Mm-hmm. Being a First Nations group that never signed a treaty with the way the legal system works, they could make some claims that this was their territory and they have some amount of control over resources and different things. And also, their focus was on salmon race restoration, so the idea that if you grow all this plankton, then it goes up the food chain and could increase your salmon runs, because they're a fishing culture. They're facing the decline of their traditional food source, which is a pretty big deal because employment there is not so great, and a lot of people really do rely on hunting and fishing and foraging for a good part of their sustenance. So they put 100 tons of iron into an eddy off in the international zone. You know, there's like 200 miles, right, around countries. That's the legal space in the oceans. And they went past that. They, over several weeks, put this iron into the ocean, got a plankton bloom. They won't know about the salmon until next year. And even when you do know, it's really hard to scientifically make those connections. But their motivation, I'm not in a good position to make claims about their motivation, but I think it's a really interesting case. I'll leave it there. Who could ask questions or discuss it more?
A lot of the people who are interested in geoengineering are people coming from like hyper free market groups who have this sort of very free market model of how climate protection will work, which is like you have a carbon tax, you start pricing in carbon into the economy, you accept like a lot of instability, so like some cities will be flooded and people will move, you deregulate so people can innovate new technologies and stuff. And I'm interested in what you think of this, because like a lot of like something you mentioned is that like we often conflate critiques of capitalism with environmental critiques, and that sometimes capitalism is good at solving some of these problems or potentially. I'm just kind of curious how you kind of see this hyper free market position.
I think the hyper free market position is based in myth and doesn't hold up, doesn't actually exist in reality, because there's always regulation. I mean, even saying that a carbon tax, the hyper free market position wouldn't include a carbon tax. It would just say, well, no, people respond to crises with innovation, and so we'll just migrate. I mean, I forget the name of the economist, but he's a young guy who's down in, I think, Chapel Hill, and I was on a television show with him, and he was saying this. He's like, well, we'll just, we'll just relocate, and the grain belts will move north, and it's like, and in the meantime, there will be, like, pogroms? I mean, how does this transition just happen? Because if you know anything about history, those kinds of social dislocations are rather difficult on people. So it's ridiculous. It's the ideology of a suicidal system. But capitalism, the Promethean qualities of capitalism, of, position on capitalism is that it's sort of very classic, very old school Marxist position, like out of the manifesto, right? Where, I mean, along with critiquing capitalism viciously, Marx says some of the most flattering things possible about capitalism. He says, look, like, this is, the bourgeoisie has covered the earth. It has erected structures that put the aqueducts and the pyramids in the shade. Like, this is an amazing system for producing wealth and infrastructure. And along the way, it produces all this suffering and inequality. And so it's the social relations of production that have to be changed. But that it's the violence and inequality of capitalism is unfortunately partly linked to this amazing process of creative destruction in which new technologies come online faster than ever before. So I think there is a role in this moment where we have to build out a clean energy sector and essentially euthanize a fossil fuel sector that there's plenty of room for that kind of like classical capitalist innovation, investment, and growth. But it only happens if there is a proper context created by the state guiding these projects. And in terms of these different technologies, I think one thing that is important is that to draw the distinction between the sort of stratosphere doping and what I had always heard referred to as carbon engineering, but you were describing it as greenhouse gas.
Yeah, the GGR is the new attempted acronym. But yeah.
This idea of pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. And I mean, the amazing thing is there is, and David Keith is involved in one of these companies, there is a pretty simple technology to strip CO2 out of the atmosphere at a rate vastly more efficient than trees can do, and then actually store this, not just as a critical gas, but turn it into sort of inert salts, is how I understand it. If civilization was serious about saving itself, if core states were serious about the science, there would be enormous... This technology would first of all just be like nationalized. All patents would be removed and be like, this is free, anyone who wants to experiment with this. And there would be an effort to build out a private and public, whatever industry, to actually do this and strip CO2 out of the atmosphere, because we're at over 400 parts per million. At no time before the Industrial Revolution were concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere above 280 parts per million. Most climate scientists think that at 350, maybe up to 450, this is when you get the tipping point. Most people think it's below 400. So we're like already over the edge in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. So it would, you know, I think that it's utopian to think that this will happen, but crazy things do happen. And that if we were serious, that would be immediately we'd be building out this infrastructure for carbon sequestration. But instead, these technologies are being licensed to the fossil fuel industry. They're being basically used as cover for continuing with business as usual. And of course, the project to create a zero-emission coal-fired power plant, I mean, it goes nowhere. And in the coal industry, officially the project is called NextGen, and in the coal industry it's called NeverGen, because they know it's just never going to happen. But it's not that actually the technology doesn't work. I mean, you can actually do that if you invest in the money in it.
So raise your hand for questions, and depending, maybe I'll take two or three at a time, just so people can kind of jump in as they care to. Maybe just stand up, and I'll point.
We left them speechless.
Or we did a bad job.
Yeah.
He came to the Nation yesterday. We had an editorial meeting with him. Yeah.
Okay, so I've heard him twice, and you know, spellbinding the picture that he paints. But I may not have gotten it, but perhaps you could elucidate. How does he or you envision entrepreneurial efforts to bring about, by 2050, he says, a 90% or perhaps zero emissions world?
It would require a de facto carbon tax, which we have the laws to do, and it's the Clean Air Act, passed in 1970, amended in 1990, and then amended by the lawsuit Massachusetts versus EPA, which the Supreme Court in 2007 said, yes, the EPA has the obligation to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And this was because the U.S. signed the Kyoto Protocol but then never ratified the treaty, because treaties have to be ratified by the Senate, according to the Constitution. So it was in response to that some green groups and states, led by Massachusetts, sued the EPA. It said, you have to regulate these gases because they constitute pollution under the Clean Air Act, because they harm human beings. So we're waiting for the EPA to issue lots of rules based on this. The Bush administration just completely ignored it. The Obama administration said they're going to follow the law. They put Lisa Jackson in as head of the EPA. She was a pretty good person, part of why she resigned. So they've there's been like a ruling on automobiles and on new coal-fired power plants, stationary sources. But the economics of coal are such that that was an easy political ruling. Nobody was going to build coal plants. But there's a lot of regulations that could be issued that would effectively raise the cost of dirty energy. And at the same time, there needs to be an extension of the production tax credit for clean energy. So part of the problem that's held clean energy development back in the U.S. is that we have a production tax credit of, I think it's like 1.7 cents per kilowatt hour, something like that, for selling clean energy. And Congress won't extend this for more than a year at a time. And if it was extended for a decade, that alone would really help investment because it would give stability because you have to, you know, price these investments out over the long term. So these are things that are all we already have that we just need, you know, to pressure the government to actually do, raise the cost of dirty energy. There's plenty of money to flow into building out clean energy. The one of the big problems that the clean tech sector faces is lack of demand. And one of the key things that the government has done historically in the development of technologies is not just invest in their startup, but also be the primary consumer. So IBM, which is essentially, you know, the mother of the modern computer industry, for the first two decades of its existence, more than half of its sales were to the federal government. You look at the history of aviation. It wasn't just that the government bought up the patents and invested in, you know, experimenting with new technologies within the military. It also bought the services of what became the airlines by saying, move the mails for us, do these things for us. And again and again and again, you find that one of the key roles that the public sector plays for technological development is to consume these things. So the government sector in the U.S. is more than a third of the economy. This is a point that the right wing makes and a lot of liberals just are afraid of. They don't know how to think about this, as opposed to saying, yes, that's great, wonderful. One third of the economy is at least theoretically accountable to the people. Well, let's do something with that. And the federal government is the largest single consumer of energy in the economy. It's not as much, it's not all military, actually. The buildings use like 75% of the electricity in the country, and the federal government has 430 mostly large, totally inefficient office buildings. Then you add in the state sector. You look at federal fleets. The post office alone has 150,000 cars, all of which travel about 18 miles a day and park in the same place every night. Absolutely no reason that that entire fleet shouldn't be electrified. So if the public sector started consuming clean tech, that would mean that the clean tech sector could achieve economies of scale simply by buying a lot of their inputs in bulk and then making savings. So I interviewed a guy who ran an electric vehicle company, and he said if I could buy components in batches of 100 rather than 5 or 10, I could save like 30% sometimes. So all the pieces are in place to basically raise the cost of dirty energy, lower the cost of clean technology through government purchasing that would then have knock-on effects throughout the economy. And there's also lots and lots of private capital that hasn't been invested. The federal government and the Federal Reserve says that the corporate sector in America is sitting on more uninvested cash than at any time since 1956. So this is not money for bonuses or stock dividends. This is money retained for investment that the firms are unclear on what to do, how to move forward. And if all of these things I've described went into effect, that would send cues to the private sector that, like, okay, you need to build out clean technology. You know, charging stations for electric vehicles, come up with systems for this. Like, that's where there's going to be profits made. So that's, in answer to your question, the role for entrepreneurs would be in relationship to cues from the state, operating in the context created by government policies such as directly and indirectly regulating costs and also stimulating demand.
So I would actually relate to this to the question that we just had about enterprise. You know, another force for creating demand is cultural production. And I think that if we had a kind of a massive effort by cultural workers in whatever sense to tell the story of the fossil fuel system we have now as basically being the dark ages and use like every medium at our disposal to frame it that way, while at the same time describing the clean tech or clean energy future in terms that are compelling, that make people who don't normally think about this stuff start to think about it. That would be huge. I feel like a lot of times I get into discussions that are kind of along the lines of the ones we've been having, and especially in David Keith's book, for example, like the idea of culture is not well understood, theorized, considered, and it's this huge force that's operating that, you know, maybe we're so much in it that we can't see it, but cultural change is so fundamental, and I don't even know how to start talking about it in a way that sounds really intelligent, but
well,
I
mean,
crucial.
Maybe for both of you and Christian, if you have anything to add too. I mean, so there's like sci-fi as one model for mm-hmm. the culture production. I know like George is a reader, right? I think you probably are too. And then George, you're working on some sound art around environmental indicators. But is there like sci-fi is a genre thing, a genre ghetto that people, you know, obviously sometimes they like sci-fi or fantasy, they like Game of Thrones. Some things get popular, but like, you know, it's. There are people who are sci-fi readers and then people who just aren't, you know, and I'm just curious whether you have anything, something that would like enter mass culture in some other kind of way seems possible, but if you'd have thoughts toward that.
Around the role of SF in the conversation?
SF or just like further thoughts around cultural production.
Well, so I think one frame that does come up, you know, we've talked, I think all three of us touched on climate tipping points, but cultures also have tipping points. And they're just as complicated, and the transitions can happen really quickly. Smoking and its changing role in the last, you know, in our lifetimes has been one that's very frequently cited. There are others. And when you look at the history of state regulation around things, it's often completely unclear, you know, why does the Cuyahoga River catches on fire? Water had been awfully dirty for an awfully long time before then, and this happens, and somehow the problem stream meets the solution stream, and arguably the most tangibly effective piece of U.S. environmental legislation, the Clean Water Act, gets passed out of this image. And so I think that cultural production is really core to that. I mean, I haven't seen... As, for example, Hollywood gets more invested in various sci-fi and fantasy properties, which has been another probably norm cascade of its own in the past 20 years, I haven't actually seen, I'm probably just forgetting them, serious treatments of climate dystopia or avoided dystopia, utopia. There's a ton in literary science fiction. Kim Stanley Robinson has a whole trilogy of near future books just on climate change, and that's not exactly techno-optimism, it's sort of scientific cultural optimism in which scientists can negotiate around some of the problems of governments trying to make decisions and move things in good directions with some human complexity. Pablo Bacigalupi, I guess, is probably the most prominent climate dystopian writer. I think all of his books now take place in one world in which that's just the consequence, but... So it'll be interesting to see if that gets picked up, either of those trends get picked up as images in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
One thing I would say about scale is I think that there is a kind of fetishization of authenticity that's linked to this, and that in the United States on the left there is always a sort of subtext that the local and the little is good and the big is bad. And, you know, this goes back to Schumacher's small is beautiful. What was the book? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you see it in the Transitions Towns movie. It's part of the horizontalism that, you know, was part of, you know, evident in Occupied Wall Street. In the Bay Area, there you hear a lot of this, and it becomes like a really rigid and totally uptight ideological fixation. And people make claims that are totally crazy, I think, about what the local can do. And there's a lot that the local can do and should do, but it really misunderstands the power of capital to think that communities can stand up to ExxonMobil on their own. It's just, you know, it's just not possible. And also the idea of the end run and the escape, a lot of that is fantasy. This is not to say that there isn't an important place for, like, the relocalization of production. I'm for that. But we also have to recognize the nature of the class struggle, as it were, essentially. You know, there are interests that make lots of money off of this, and what they want is to continue doing that. And it's not class struggle in terms of workers and employers, but in terms of those who accumulate vast fortunes off of business as usual versus those who would force them to change and lose money in the process. And in that struggle, there has to be institutions big enough to go up against those corporations. And I don't see what that can be other than the state. I mean, the state is the only institution that can say, look, no, here you will not go, and we will put you in jail if you don't pay the fine, et cetera, et cetera. And then even at state levels, I mean, just in terms of rebuilding, like I live part-time in Vermont, and I'm from Vermont originally, and, you know, the rebuilding from Hurricane Irene, which wasn't even a hurricane by the time it hit, but it did a lot of damage, there's only 620,000 people in Vermont, and it would have been really, really hard for Vermont to pay for that by itself. And there was a lot of federal money that came in to the state. And that kind of geographic redistribution is another very important thing that has to do with social justice and scale. So that's my pitch for not getting caught up in romanticizing the local.
But
I might quickly add to that. I think that it's interesting to look at how these different scales can work together. And I think that, you know, with talking about the state, it's the interesting question is, how does the state get the legitimacy to take a certain position? And part of that is, you know, movement building or coalitions or discursive positions that get caught up by often a small group. Like, for example, with this case I was talking about in British Columbia, Haida Gwaii, Canada, that whole event would have probably gone under the radar if it wasn't for a very small NGO, the ETC group, who has 9 members and $1 million budget and is consistently the group that's occupying a really huge discursive space. So they got The Guardian involved, the UK newspaper. There became a press frenzy, basically. And then it went up to the Environment Minister of Canada, who launched an investigation, resulting in a lot of legal procedures. And that just got so much on the radar from this one community and this one discursive position working now in international law in the end. So it's just interesting, the relationships between these different scales. Hmm.
And I would, I guess, briefly echo that. I mean, one interesting... I live in San Francisco now, where the third or fourth, depending on how you count, tech bubble is well underway, right? And the idea there, of course, is that you start out with a very, very small door-to-door seeding thing, and then you get into the middle part of the encounter function, and you reach your ultimate market penetration. And the open question is whether that actually works for anything that isn't a photo sharing site based on cat pictures, right? So, and there are, but I think it is a very interesting question that Holly raises about, you know, take cigarettes. There was a lot of cultural activism around it, and there was just a lot of regulation. And it's not necessarily clear that one led to the other, but they were happening at the same time, and it was true that also people weren't seeing other people smoking in restaurants because you could no longer smoke in restaurants. Right? There was no longer a smoking section.
Part of why people are doing that is because taxes went up. Like in New York, we have a $4 tax on cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. So we do have interesting models of combined pushes, sometimes by constituencies that don't actually like each other, but that are that happen to be working in harmony, that have led to big changes. Now, I think the haunting question around climate is, if you were going to design a bad problem, it would be this one, because there's also this time lag thing, and that really bollocks things. And the fact, I mean, if the main argument for considering SRM is that it actually, you know, it is in a small pool of things that have quick effects, we are still dealing with a norm cascade could happen quickly. The ocean would stay warm for a while because of physics. So, again, I think that's an argument for more urgency now and not a council of despair, but it does complicate the scaling questions to some extent.
Yeah, I would just want to concur. I think, like, this point about, like, local movements, this is absolutely key. I mean, that is one of the places where the local, I mean, there can't be any other sort of place for people to get involved but the local in social movements to some extent. They always take place in some sort of specific local context, and they, what I was talking about in terms of the state is not like where does one as a citizen plug themselves in, mm-hmm. but what institutions are ultimately going to check the problem. And then the question is, well, what would cause the state to do that? You know, a swarming of social movements that pressure it. And I agree with everything that was said about that. I mean, you could look at the civil rights movement as a perfect example of that, right? Small, local, particular issue to the South, and it achieves a kind of critical mass, and then suddenly everyone in the country is like, oh yeah, you know, de jure segregation, that's bad, we're against it.
Vietnam War, same thing. You have social movements at home, and then you have soldiers killing commanding officers, and it's those two things work together in a sense.
Maybe I'll start taking a few questions at a time. So, you two?
And mine was just a point of discussion, more so than a question, but last night I was at dinner with Yvette Solnit, and she spoke about a carbon dependent economy, the comparison to a slave dependent economy, and how movements at many different scales, social movements, and she made a comparison of underground railroad movements. Citizens feeling that they could fight against the state and do things to change. Maybe we need to be looking back at some of those time periods where we felt like there was no way out and no other economy. So I don't have a question, but I just want to focus that.
Breaking the Chains is, I would argue, a good book on exactly that subject. How did that movement happen? But absolutely.
Regulatory scientific apparatus where the state, or even like multiple states, could actually develop consensus around this is a form of intervention that we would actually want to actively engage in. Like how even, what would be the institutions necessary, what would be the steps for actually developing that kind of architecture and developing that kind of agreement?
Yeah, do you want to reply to either of those questions or the comment?
I think others on the panel will be more familiar with the first question. I guess I could speak briefly to the second, that one problem that hasn't, I think, been brought up is that it's very, well, no, you brought it up in the CDR in the Russ George context, it's really unclear how you do experiments that are designed to give you guidance about whether the techniques are successful at scale, because you have to do so much of them, arguably, to get out of the noise that's existing in the weather system, driven by the climate system, that at that point you're just doing it anyway. And so then that moves in the direction of, well, you use some sort of decision-making process that's hopefully not a terrible one and is hopefully democratically inclusive and international to decide that you need to try it. You just start deploying it, and then you have monitoring that says, okay, we're going to shut this down in a controlled way if the consequences are as terrible as some models think they might be. An open legal question, of course, this is obvious to everyone, but whether it should go through the Framework Convention on Climate Change or whether that ship has sailed into an iceberg and there needs to be some new body, but starting new international bodies is also very challenging. A lot of the recent discussion legally has been about mini-lateral collections of core economies kind of making the decision, or a sufficiently large group of small economies deciding to try to stake out territory in the face of existential crisis. But is that a particularly helpful answer? I mean, the governance details are endless, but I don't know if they orient in a particularly helpful way.
Yeah, I mean, at the local state level, single state, I mean, you know, the EPA presumably would have to be involved in this, whether or not the experiments or would cause pollution. So it'd have to be some sort of review like that. And I think, yeah, it's realistically the UNFCCC process, as kind of broken down as it is, it's sort of the one we have that deals with climate change. It did create the Kyoto Protocol, which, you know, mostly didn't have that much of an impact, but I think it's not realistic to think we can invent a whole new international arrangement.
Anything regarding the social campaigns?
Yeah, so I'd have to really think a lot about this, but you could say that the ETC group has been pretty successful in recent years.
What does ETC stand for?
Erosion technology concentration.
The right, it's almost never deacronymed these days.
Yeah. So yeah. What work do they do?
So they're often termed a watchdog group, and they actually came from starting discussion maybe in the 70s or 80s about seeds. Yep. So one of the big analogs to the geoengineering debate is genetic engineering, and they were really worried about the politics of proprietary seeds and other issues. And I did a media content analysis in 2010 about geoengineering, and I found then that the discourse was pretty much entirely driven by scientists, and these papers would never quote citizens or environmental groups. And now you see that almost every issue article that comes up on geoengineering includes a quote from them or another group. So I feel like they've been successful in framing this. But I was thinking if the Arab Spring and the emphasis on inequality and dignity and, you know, I think we talk about inequality in our society a lot more, probably because of Occupy as well, than we did a few years ago. And the Mitt Romney's comments might have lost him the election on that. And then I was also thinking in terms of changes that didn't require a strategized campaign, this might be a reach, but the way we think about cities in 2013 as opposed to in the 80s and suburbs. Now the city is a place of innovation where you want to go to, and the suburb is the place to escape from. And I think that's flipped, and that was a whole different host of reasons, not necessarily a campaign. So
I think gay marriage, right? Marriage equality. I mean, that the issue has been successfully shifted to human rights and civil rights for citizens. Not like the question of whether or not one should or shouldn't do certain things with their genitals. Like that has successfully been dropped out, and that's irrelevant. And the question is, why is there a group of people who don't have full civil rights? That has to be explained, or it has to be changed. So,
I had a question based on that, and this comes up here and there. But like, what is the correct framework for thinking about? You know, like the kind of dominant policy framework is really cost benefit analysis, and like economic production now or in the future. You could imagine like a really rights-based approach, or one based around like an expanded idea of nature, or something else. Like, is there like an ethical framework for framing these issues more broadly that you kind of find potentially productive in terms of like why we have to act now, that that would actually get people on board, you know. Like, does nature have rights? Like, do individual groups have, like, rights to, I don't know, staying on? I'm not even sure, like what, and that's what, like, one thing that makes these discussions really difficult is that people kind of agree that climate change is bad, but they don't, it's not pressing enough on them to want to act now, necessarily. Right.
Well, so, I mean, one thought on that, and it's not a happy thought, I don't take any pleasure in it, is that the sense that at some point, if things go the way we think that they probably will and that we're worried they go, there will be, you know, 3 or 4 times Sandy-type individual events, and those events will have a lot of causes, climate change being among them. And if a few happen close enough in time to create the sense of a real new future, and if they're severe enough, and if the conversation around attribution, I mean, and I guess the Bloomberg cover after Sandy in New York was, you know, an attempt to sort of attempt to influence the attribution discussion, meaning was this, do we think about this from a climate frame or from a there have always been bad disasters frame? And you have a very short window of time in which to do that, and there are always going to be a lot of competing voices. And it's also not true that things have single causes, which means if you're trying to be intellectually honest and even emotionally honest, you have to admit some complexity. But enough of that combined, so in the regulatory theory frame that I tried to lay out earlier, that's the problem stream, and it reaches a certain point. Then you reach into the solution stream and grab what's available, and that's a scary step because it may be that what you reach for is Bay Area-style tech entrepreneurship 100%, open up the floodgates, and that doesn't necessarily move you in the right direction. Pick your preferred, you know, solution proposal of concern. But you could see that kind of, you know, thinking about what to do if such a pattern occurs in advance may be fruitful as opposed to just thinking, well, what do we do right now? Because the situation will keep changing and will keep evolving often very quickly. And that's a potential to go in a bad direction as well as a good one.
Any last questions? We'll just take in the back, and that's maybe our last one.
So I was at COP15, and in terms of involved, I'm probably going to try to get involved around Paris with some scenario stuff, not Warsaw. I did some work for an organization called Islands First, which is a terrific organization based in New York that is capacity building for legal support for small island states at these conferences, mainly through the AOSIS, Association of Small Island States. And Ambassador Stuart Beck made the point that actually, and you know, maybe this ties back around to the question of existing state institutions. He said, if these things were happening in New York, we wouldn't have a problem because every country in the world has all of its legal and technical support in New York. And he saw it not as a conspiracy exactly, but as a very effective way of diffusing the problem was to create this superficial international layer where, honestly, a lot of the representatives and a lot of the people going to support there spend the first 2 days getting over jet lag and spend the last 3 days arguing with police to be allowed to go into the building, which was the COP15 experience, rather than actually supporting any of the non-powerful countries, whereas major states are able to rent office space and do things like stay overnight working in the building rather than having to go home. And my impression, not having been to, I've been to intersessionals but not major meetings since COP15, is that that has gotten significantly worse. civil society, which in this case also means a lot of lawyers and negotiating support teams, has been more and more excluded from the process. And I think that's why I'm so discouraged about that, is that direction. Not that international negotiations are not promising, I think they're essential, but it's cultural, the culture that's built up around that one on a very detailed level has been discouraging to me, seeing all of the African delegates struggling for space in the computer lab while the U.S. delegation walks off to its rented offices.
Yeah, no, I've not been involved, but, you know, it's for social groups, social movements to, you know, have an effect, and that's the way one would get involved, I think. One thing in terms of the changing of debate, to get back to that, I think something interesting is going on in Bolivia with this discussion about Wayne Bevere, living well, you know, trying to define prosperity in a new way that's not just about accumulation. And which at first I thought, like, okay, whatever, semantics, this is like kind of silly. Like, people just, you know, people just want jobs and they want to feed their kids and, you know, have one or two pairs of shoes, and this doesn't really matter. But it's really had traction internationally. And I think we might be seeing something, some sort of shift in terms of how we think about the economy and what its function is that could be very useful.
Maybe just to, both of you are taking part on the committee of conference coming up that's around geoengineering. Maybe, mm-hmm. Could you maybe speak to that a little bit and then to wrap things up?
So we had a lot of discussions about what this should even be called. We decided on critical global discussions, both in critical as in urgent, necessary, but critical as in, you know, the process of interrogating some of these ideas with the critical mindset. And this is the first conference on climate engineering that's been transdisciplinary, but inviting people in that aren't just academics or scientists to take part.
And I think that one emphasis that we're trying to work on is really robustly broadening the discussion around it, because thus far, since Asilomar, it really has been the same, I mean, what, 120 people who keep seeing each other at meetings. And that's not due to deliberate walls that have been constructed. Everybody laments this, but you do hear the same arguments, and you don't get the kind of thing that the scientific method depends on, which is wildly contrasting competing models getting compared to one another and sort of dialecting it out. And if the conference is an opportunity to bring in people who have worked in other parts of climate and get their, you know, robust criticisms of GE, I think that's a good thing.
When and where is this going to be?
This is going to be in Berlin in late August. I think I said September earlier. Those were the original dates. If anyone is interested in these subjects, it's an, you know, an open call, and you're asked to present your thoughts. But we could set up an email point of contact here. You know, I could just take everybody's and send out a contact list. It's called CEC14, if anyone wants to Google it.
And I'm also sensitized to the fact that I've been talking about this long enough that I might not even know how to explain it in a coherent way to people that aren't familiar with the topic. So if you have some ideas like, hey, this didn't make sense, or you really lost me here, I would love to hear that kind of feedback.
Okay, thank you, George, Holly, and Christian. And we're having a second one of these roundtables in our space in Greenpoint on November 23rd around the idea of nature. So please come back. And thank you all for coming on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, thanks.